This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I am Josh Fennett. Coming up today...
Landscape architecture, quite simply, is an art and a science, and it's a shaping of the built and natural world.
We'll get the lie of the land as a major new prize for landscape architecture looks to make us aware of the designs beneath our feet and between our buildings. Also ahead...
To see the designs as just a kind of decorative feature is to underestimate Morris as a designer and a thinker and a campaigner.
We'll keep things natural with a look at a new book celebrating British print and textile designer William Morris and his love of flowers. Blooming marvellous, if you ask me. And we'll be looking ahead to the Design Biennale in Zurich, too. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. And a very warm welcome to Monocle on Design. Architecture may be flush with awards, but its outdoorsy sibling, landscape architecture, has long gone without. Now, thanks to the Washington-based Cultural Landscape Foundation, the discipline is finally getting its first international award. With an $100,000 purse up for grabs, the new prize will be awarded every 2 years to a landscaper of note. A 5-person jury will select the first winner in 2021. Monocle's Nick Manise, himself a trained landscape architect, recently spoke to Charles Birnbaum, founder of the Cultural Landscape Foundation. He began by asking a very pertinent question indeed. What does a landscape architect actually do?
I always begin by saying that landscape architects are the perfect orchestrators to deal with the built environment. And in dealing with the built environment, there has to be first an understanding, an analysis of a site, as well as its natural and cultural conditions. I think that landscape architects can be a small garden. They can be a campus. It could be park or parkway or boulevard system or network. It can be plazas. It could be dealing with toxic sites. And so you can see immediately you've stopped listening to that answer. And I think one of the challenges is that landscape architecture, quite simply, is an art and a science, and it's a shaping of the built and natural world.
What's the background of the Cultural Landscape Foundation? How did you guys come to be?
I'm trained as a landscape architect, and I worked in the private sector for about a decade in the beginning in the 1980s. And I had the good fortune at that time of working on many of the nation's most celebrated works of landscape architecture. So, for example, Prospect Park in Brooklyn, the Olmsted and Vaux masterpiece, Boston's Emerald Necklace, designed by Olmsted and other protégés in his office over several decades, the first urban greenway in the world, I would argue a possible World Heritage Site, Andrew Jackson Downing's extant landscape Springside, and a host of others. And one of the things that I witnessed during that time in the private sector was that landscape architects, by and large, didn't value history and culture at the same level in which they were trained to be good stewards of nature and ecology. So that was the first dilemma. The second thing was, in 1992, I went to the National Park Service, to the federal government, to set policy for specifically historic and cultural landscapes. So in the U.S., in a way that we have had standards and guidelines in place as a result of the Historic Preservation Act of 1966 for historic buildings, we did not have those for landscapes. And so when I went to the government in 92, I spent the next 5 years as the author, editor, and then getting these guidelines ratified. They're required by law if you're going to have state or federal funds. And so it provides a framework to be good stewards for America's landscape heritage. Now, after completing that, one of the things that I realized is that, I mean, I think I realized this before then, but, you know, landscapes are not buildings. People have emotional connections to landscape. Gardening and golf are amongst the nation's favorite pastimes. And one of the things that I thought was kind of a bit wacky about that was this sort of top-down approach. Sticks, not carrots. And what we really needed to do is teach people how to see and how to value landscape more broadly beyond what I often refer to as the bees and bunnies. And so I had the good fortune in 97, 98 of being a Loeb Fellow at Harvard's Graduate School of Design, with the goal of incubating and creating the Cultural Landscape Foundation, which was to be a non-membership organization where everything was free and open, available on our website. And this is around the time that the web was just starting to take off. And that's where we started. And it was a volunteer gig for 9 years. And today we're a staff of 10. The International Prize in Landscape Architecture is our fourth programmatic leg in our table.
Building on that, you mentioned that it was volunteer for the first few years. How's the foundation funded now?
So the foundation is funded very diversely, and whether it's funding from our board of directors and our stewardship council, we do a lot of programming. About every 18 months, we have a big conference. Our conference this year, which is looking at the role that landscape architects play in shaping cities, is focusing on Dallas, Texas. And that's October 3rd through 5th of this year. And it really shows in cities like Dallas that landscape architects play a leadership role in shaping the future of a city. But also what's intriguing to me is we also see that in many cases, things haven't changed in 100 years. 100 years ago in Dallas, for example, George Kessler, who was the planner landscape architect, he's often referred to as the Olmsted of the Midwest, who laid out the Kansas City Park and Boulevard system, among other places. When Kessler went to Dallas in the early 20th century, what he found was a city that had to deal with a river that was flooding. He was challenged with connectivity. Although they wouldn't call it equity then, they were dealing with people who lived in the high grounds and the low grounds. And they were looking at the need for an increased amount of open space. And even then, they were witnessing in that 10-year period a 300% growth in that city, which sort of echoes the need for the prize today. We've got 75% of our culture who are going to be living in cities by 2050. We're looking at 9 billion people on Earth. So hardly a good enough number of landscape architects to address that at this point.
The interesting thing about it for me is that it's not for a particular landscape project, which so many prizes seem to be. It's rather for the body of work of a landscape architect. Why was honouring a designer's legacy more important than, say, honouring a one-off landscape project?
Before I answer that question, as a setup to that, I want to tell a personal story. As we were crafting the need for the prize, you know, of course, the Pritzker has been in place since 1979. It's 40 years old today. It didn't start being known at the level that it is, and that really is the gold standard today. You see RFPs that come out for cultural institutions that mandate for consideration that the architect is a Pritzker Prize-winning architect. So it's been enormously successful. In the case of landscape architecture, there is the Jellicoe Prize, which comes out of the UK. It doesn't have a cash prize, and that has been around for some time. There are myriad other prizes. But in the U.S., for example, there is the National Medal of Arts. I think there's about 350 recipients to date. There have only been 4 landscape architects in the history of the program. And the last to receive the National Medal of Arts from the president was Laurie Olin in 2012. Laurie, of course, worked on the Docklands in the U.K. and a panoply of projects in the U.S. that changed the way we deal with waterfronts and the revitalization of projects like Bryant Park. Over the last year, I ran into Laurie at the National Building Museum by chance, and Laurie is a very upbeat person, and one of the things that he said to me that day was, quote, "I'm going to outlive my legacy." And so this was kind of a remarkable statement to hear on many levels, but if you think that landscape architecture is an art form, which I believe, shouldn't it be considered in the same way as stewards as we look at the future continuum of telling the story of our individual cultures? And so with the prize, I think one of the things that became immediately clear to us is in conceiving this, that first and foremost, the prize had to raise the visibility and value of both the profession, but it would also aim to honor and to fortify the legacy of the individual designer or designers that are being recognized. So we have a three-legged sort of stool that we approach everything with. I would say that this applies to the prize program as well. Make visible, instill value, and engage.
Charles Birnbaum, the founder of the Cultural Landscape Foundation there, speaking to Monocle's Nick Manise. And you can find out more about their work at tclf.org. You're listening to Monocle on Design. In a moment, we'll be reassessing a design classic, the work of print and textile designer William Morris. Do stay with us. In the 19th century, many of the UK's cities were clouded in the literal and metaphorical smog of the Industrial Revolution. One designer, however, was looking to the nation's crafty past and sunlit uplands for inspiration. William Morris is a cornerstone of the British design identity, with his floral motifs for fabric, wallpaper and furniture that have found their way into locations ranging from St James's Palace in London to high street fashion retailers. A man of many talents, Morris is almost equally well known as a poet, novelist and social activist, who left us a phrase that I often personally ponder. Have nothing in your house that you do not know to be useful or believe to be beautiful. Wise words, I think you'll agree. But I digress. There's a new book, William Morris's Flowers, which collects some of his most influential designs. Monocle's Tom Hall recently met with the author, Rowan Bain, at the William Morris Gallery in Walthamstow, East London, where she is also the senior curator. Here's what they had to say.
So apart from East 17, the band, William Morris is probably the most famous person to come out of Walthamstow in East London. So he was born here at a time in 1834 when Walthamstow was a kind of rural suburb of London. So the people that lived in this area were generally quite wealthy. So they had all the kind of benefits of having countryside whilst still easily commutable into central London.
Was he distinctly of the land, or was he someone who also had an awareness of, you know, the city and urban and urbane thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. He was, you know, he was London born and bred, really. And he was well aware of the kind of rapid pace of change in industrial Victorian Britain. And although you could see that his designs are kind of bringing in a kind of bucolic idea of the English countryside, he is by no means someone who's looking at nature in a nostalgic way or in a kind of idealistic way. He brings in the British countryside into people's homes, and he's thinking about how people live in urban environments. And I think you can see the way he uses flowers and nature as actually a kind of statement against this rapid industrialisation that actually he sees as destroying the land. So I think you can see that this comes through, and he was a political person. So to see the designs as just a kind of decorative feature is to underestimate Morris as a designer and a thinker and a campaigner.
I think it's really easy for people to see, you know, anything that perhaps has floral motifs or something that feels in any way a little bit traditional, and they completely remove it from the person themselves, because he was at times quite radical. He was a leftist. He was quite passionately about, you know, empowering the greater public. And these were ideas that probably didn't sit well with the British establishment at the time.
Yeah, and Morris himself really became disillusioned. When he became a designer, it was really to see how he could try and make people's lives better through good design. These are ideas that were picked up by the Bauhaus, for example, and later designers. And I think we have Morris to kind of credit for the way we think about how design can improve your life. However, the way he chose to make his patterns and his designs was quite expensive, so normal people couldn't afford it. And of course, he then did get picked up by rich people in Victorian Britain, and he became really the height of fashion. You know, if you had money, you had Morris & Co. interiors. In later life, he became kind of conflicted because he said, you know, his designs were picked up by the swinish luxuries of the rich, he said. So quite damning against his clients and the people that had made him wealthy.
But he was quite rich, and so he came from money, didn't he?
He came from money. You know, you could see that maybe that's hypocritical, but actually there aren't many people that come from that kind of wealth and then want to make the world a different place, and they think about people that don't have money. And he's by no means a kind of champagne socialist. He really wants a wholesale revolution. He wants revolutionary change. He wants, you know, production in the hands of the workers. That is what he wants. And that's quite controversial to the people that, you know, the kind of circles he's kind of mixing in at that time. So we're standing in front of one of Morris's first designs for wallpaper. It's a trellis, like a garden trellis, with a rose growing up it. And in between the flowers and the roses, these lovely birds and small little insects. So this is Morris's first design for wallpaper, and it's quite controlled in a way because of the squares of the trellis kind of control the pattern. But this shows Morris's kind of quintessential approach to design, that he has this way of using the rose, which is climbing up the wallpaper, but it's controlled by this trellis. So Morris always thinks about nature and using plants and flowers in a controlled way. So he said if they scatter all over the paper, it means it's going to be a kind of random pattern and it's not going to be enjoyable. But by controlling it, it brings a kind of more harmonious pattern.
As you say, we're looking at this sort of trellis design, a grid design with the flowers threading all the way through it, and it's got a real kind of almost like industrial heft to the heavy lines and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. He uses definite line, all the flowing of the vine, the kind of rose flows into each other. There are no lines that just kind of trail off and go into nothing. He has definite outlines, definite shapes. You can't always identify all the flowers in Morris's patterns. So when I was writing the book, that was one of my main challenges. I'd be staring at a kind of basic flower shape thinking, you know, what is this? Is there some kind of meadow flower that I can't identify? But actually I gave up on it because it's pointless. Because, you know, he's not trying to do a direct representation. He's taking elements of it. And maybe he started with an idea of a flower and then he thought, you know what, I want five petals, not six. So he chose the design over the reality.
I do wonder, when you talk about these really quite forward-thinking methods, did he see himself as a sort of rootsy, craftsy kind of designer, or did he see himself as a bit of a fairly ruthless industrialist trying to sort of push things forward?
Well, I think it's maybe a mixture of both. It's not simple with Morris. So the great thing about Morris and what makes him such a good designer is that he learned how to do everything himself. He taught himself how to embroider, for example, when he was in his early 20s. And not many young men are going to be sitting at home doing embroidery, but he did that because he wanted to learn how to do it. So when you learn something, you can then understand the limitations and potential of, and you can break the rules or you can use those rules. So that's what makes him a great designer. He knows how to make things by hand and he respects craftsmanship. But he is a commercial businessman. For example, he decorated St. James's Palace and he knew that that royal connection with royalty was the British public were going to go mad for it. So he produced his own version of St. James's wallpaper for the general public and it was really popular because he knew, you know, that it was going to be a commercial success. And he had a factory and it was quite a beautiful factory. He planted flowers all around the edge of the factory and his workers had gardens and allotments. However, it wasn't by any means a kind of socialist utopia. And he himself later wrote about how a factory might be and he talked about the ideals of a factory, but he actually didn't achieve that in his lifetime.
Where would we be seeing Morris's designs kind of in the mainstream today? Do they still have that influence?
Absolutely. I see Morris, it's like a curse when you work here because you see Morris everywhere. I walk down the street and I can see someone's wearing a shirt, carrying an umbrella. Morris actually would have probably objected to that because he was so specific about the way he wanted his patterns to be used. One that's really popular at the moment is Blackthorn, and it's a quite dark wallpaper with lovely jewelled colours. And it was made by Morris's kind of disciple, Henry Dell, who worked for Morris and was very influenced by his style. But I've seen it worked really well in cocktail bars. It kind of creates a dark atmosphere. Another one is Morris's really early design is Daisy, and that's really big in Scandinavia, and it really fits with a kind of light wood. You might have a plain wall, but just one wall with Daisy wallpaper on it. So he's constantly being adapted and reintroduced to interiors and clothing, as you say.
I find that trickle down of design that's now getting into a century or centuries old kind of interesting, as in, because at the time when people would have been buying William Morris's stuff from him directly, I guess there would have been an element of a statement about it. Either they were perhaps aligned with his politics and they found him an inspiring man from that side, or as you say, I mean, he kind of trod this, he had a foot in both camps and he did things for the royal family as well. And so I guess it was very aspirational as well. When people buy, say, a shirt from a high street chain and it's got a William Morris design, on a very subconscious level, what kind of statement is someone wearing a William Morris-esque design saying that they're not even quite aware of, really?
Yeah, I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because I see cheap clothing with Morris patterns on and I can't but think of Morris and how dismayed he'd be at the workers that were exploited to make that. For example, my mum's a lifelong Labour supporter and she was campaigning for Labour and she knocked on a door. The owner wasn't in, but she could see that they had Morris wallpaper. So she thought, OK, I've got a sympathetic person living in this house. I'm going to come back and give them some leaflets. So when she came back, she knocked on the door and this man answered and, you know, she did her spiel about why he should vote Labour. And in no uncertain terms, he basically told her to F off. And my mum was so affronted that someone could have William Morris wallpaper in their house and not be socialist. So you can definitely have William Morris on your wall, but have absolutely no affinity for his politics.
I mean, that is the power of design in itself, isn't it? And it really shouldn't be about politics, should it? It should be about whether you like what you see.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I think Morris wouldn't have agreed with that, but he was a commercial man, and as soon as he opened a shop, people did what they wanted to do with his patterns, and he had no control.
A sale is a sale.
Exactly.
Rowan Bain there, speaking to Tom Hall at the William Morris Gallery in East London. And Rowan's book, William Morris's Flowers, is out now, published by Thames and Hudson. You're listening to Monocle on Design. We'll be getting a sneak preview of the Design Biennale Zurich in just a moment. Don't go anywhere. The Design Biennale Zurich is a growing event for the city, which is now in its second instalment and kicks off this Thursday, the 29th of August, that is. Monocle's man in Switzerland, Carlo Silberschmidt, met with the event's co-founder and curator, Gabriella Chicherio, at our Zurich bureau in Seefeld to learn a little more.
I think the Swiss design scene is very international. This could be because we are in the middle of Europe, not part of Europe, but in the very middle of it. And it's very international. And I think there are these the design schools that are really good and they form a lot of talented designers. So I think Swiss design is also known in the world, especially in graphic design. Swiss style is very famous. It's not very like crazy. But I think it's functional, it's like well done, it's practic, and there is still a little bit of humor, not too much, not too, you know, it's like maybe like Swiss people are a little bit.
And this Design Biennale is spread across the city of Zurich. What are some of the key venues or where can we venture to experience the Design Biennale?
So like the first location that is our center kind of, it's at the former SBB, so the train company workshop in Altstetten. This is also the main venue and the biggest one. And then we have at the Museum für Gestaltung, we have the Swiss Game Design Lounge. And the third venue is the Old Botanical Garden in the city center where you can like discover outdoor installations. So we have product, we have game, we have interaction design, we have textile design, we have scenography a little bit, and so it's like design installations you can test and discover.
And you launched this conference 2 years ago. What was the idea behind this conference or this Design Biennale?
We missed that in Switzerland is like design event happening where you really talk about design and not final products. So it's not a fair. You cannot buy anything. And it's really about explaining design process, explaining what design can be and the different disciplines. And as all people working for Design Biennale, or more or less all people, we are all designers ourselves. And so we really want to talk what we do, what is our job, what design can do, and not really like sell something that is done.
And the Design Biennale has a very vast program. You mentioned it from interaction design. But one particular one that might be a bit unexpected to some of our listeners is the Swiss Game Design Lounge. What can visitors expect there?
So we, or our guest curator, Maike Thies, she made a selection of like the most surprising games from Switzerland. So a really important part for the selection or aspect for the selection was that they are experimental and they have a big part of design. So There are projects that are hand-drawn or that like work with vector graphics. And these are like unknown parts in games normally. And so we would like to invite people to discover like these new generation of game designer.
And also the rest of the Biennale shows a very different or not a very cliche picture of Swiss design. What would you say makes the Zurich Design Biennale different than other design events in Switzerland?
That we really focus on the process and that we try to be not commercial. So this is kind of hard to organize something without being commercial, but we really go deeply into the products and into the projects, and we search like designers who work in an interesting matter.
And there's also a conference where you have invited a number of speakers to talk about their processes and how they work. What can we expect at the conference?
So it's a conference. We were thinking about what we would love to have as a conference. And what we don't like are these long, day-long conferences with a lot of introduction. And then you have the main speaker and you wait for hours to listen to him or to her. So we wanted to shorten it for a maximum and to invite only the main speakers. And with no, like, all these, introduction part, we just put it away. And as our theme this year is play, we thought about moderation. And so we don't have a moderation now, or we have a moderation, but it's not a person. It's a moderation bot. So it's a computer voice and an animated moderator. Her name is Paula, and she will guide through the whole conference. And so this is also part of this, like, what can happen or how could a conference be to be, like, entertaining and playful.
And a very future and forward-thinking experiment as well, as it sounds.
Yeah, for us it's really an experiment. We don't know exactly what happens, but we are really happy to know that all these, like, boring parts, also like this, It's important to say thank you to all the partners, but on the other hand, it's always a little bit like you do it and it's not comfortable for everyone. So this time it will be different, as like Paula will do it in her way. So this could be then really funny.
Gabriella Quiquerio there, speaking to Carlo Silberschmidt. The Design Biennale Zurich kicks off this week on the 29th of August 2019. Do head down if you're in the city. Sadly, that's all we have time for on today's show, but don't forget, if you need a few more design-minded finds in your life, you can subscribe to this show and our sister podcast, Monocle on Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. You could also head to your local newsstand and seek out a copy of the Monocle Summer Weekly newspaper or the latest issue of Monocle magazine, if that's your thing. Monocle on Design was produced by Tom Hall. It was edited by May Lee Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.